All right, we're live, so we are streaming. We have two people in. We have a big storm in Sacramento today, so here we are. Let's open with prayer. Lord, we do thank you that we can make it in today, despite the weather. We thank you for dry buildings, that the power is on, and we know, Lord, that others are they're dealing with flooding today and power outages and those kinds of things. So we pray, Lord, that you'd we thank you for the rain, first of all, because we know that we desperately need it here in Central California. And we ask, Lord, that you would be with us through the storm and give us your peace. Be with us as we continue to study the book of Romans. This we ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. So this week, I wanted us to pay a little attention. We'll see how much we get through. And I realized that most of the time when we talk about the Apostle Paul, we think about Paul as a Jew. And we think about Paul as a Jew who comes down to Jerusalem and defends his faith and his people against, at least initially before his Damascus Road experience in the book of Acts. We think of him as a Jew. And the more I was working on the book of Romans and the more I was working on this study, the more I realized he's not just a Jew, he's also a Roman citizen. And we tend to look at those passages in the book of Acts where he sort of plays the Roman citizenship card as sort of a legal nicety to get out of things. But he, you know, last week we talked about the fact that each of us has all of these layers. So if I think about myself, I think about, let's say, my mother's Frisian and my father's Jewish roots from the Netherlands. That's sort of the immigration layer. You know, there's my great-grandparents' layer. And then my father growing up in parsonages around the Midwest, my mother in Massachusetts, there's another layer. Then there's sort of the Dutch Christian Reformed layer. And then there's my growing up in New Jersey layer. And then there's my time in the Dominican Republic layer. And now my almost 25 years in Sacramento layer here at Living Stones. We have all of these layers, and it very much produces who we are. And all of these things we take to our faith and to our perspective on God and what we believe. And I mentioned last week that the Apostle Paul has his Jewishness and now his Romanness. And it's exactly even that bridge between them that will become this movement that eventually will capture the Roman Empire. On this, now I'm playing with PowerPoint in Sunday school. Of course, I've had PowerPoint in the church service for a long time. But part of why I always missed PowerPoint in Sunday school is I'd have to print stuff out on paper to show you a nice graph. But I can show it now via PowerPoint. Now Rick can, you know, pop it on the screen. This chart in the middle is not a weather map. It's called the, basically, it's the Christian center of gravity. And if you imagine sort of the dispersion of Christianity around the world, you can sort of see where Christianity has migrated through the centuries. And if you look at, you know, you say, well, why is it way down there in Africa? It's because Africa and Asia are becoming new centers of Christianity. This is not true of any other major world religion. Judaism, to a degree, continues to be centered, especially now after the Second World War. It was sort of north in Russia and Europe, but centered in Jerusalem. Islam tends to be centered in Mecca and in today what we call Saudi Arabia. Buddhism and Hinduism further over to the east. Christianity has continued to jump cultures again and again and again and travel all over the world. And I believe this is because of what happens here in Paul. It's no accident that Paul makes up so much of the New Testament, because as I mentioned last week, if you decide you want to be a Jew or go into Judaism, you learn Hebrew. If you want to go into Islam, you learn Arabic in order to read the Quran in its own language. Right at the beginning of Christianity, they read the Bible in Greek, which was a translation that was done in the first century before Christ. And that then became the Bible of this new church. And so right from the beginning, Christianity began to spread and take root in other cultures and other places all around the world. Now, a couple of weeks ago in my sermon, I talked about Roman divinizing language and how it gets appropriated by the God of Israel, by the church. And this, I think, partially has a lot to do with Paul, and it has a lot to do with just the natural process of what happens when, well, Maury, we've got a little rain, don't we? Over an inch already. Wow. That's a good storm already. And is this gonna keep going throughout the day?
On and off.
On and off. So Rick just put up the weather map onto the stream. It's not on there because we don't have the stream there. I've got this little computer showing what Rick puts up. So when you think about, if we think about evangelicalism, we think about the Protestant Reformation, what happens when any group comes to Christ is, we talked a minute ago about all of these layers that make up a person and even a civilization. When they come to Christ, they take all of this stuff and it somehow has to make sense together in their faith. In other words, the categories that they bring to the faith have to somehow take a hold of the faith and come together. And this is what we see in the Roman Empire. So Paul has a missionary challenge that he is uniquely qualified. So if you remember the story, the church is in Jerusalem at the day of Pentecost, and you have this miracle of the languages, okay? And then they stay there, and then there's a dispute between the Greek-speaking widows and the Hebraic widows. And so what the disciples decide to do is, in a sense, ordain 7 men to take care of the Greek-speaking widows. Why were there so many Greek-speaking widows in Jerusalem? Any idea? They're from the dispersion. And there was at the time also a belief that when the resurrection happened, because the Jews were anticipating a resurrection, you'd have to be resurrected in Jerusalem. So the rabbis had all of these ideas of people who were buried, that they'd somehow travel underneath the earth to get all the way back to Jerusalem to be resurrected. So what would happen would be when people would get elderly, they would move to Jerusalem. That would also make it easier for them to participate in the feasts and the Passover and all of those things. So you had all of this population in Jerusalem that were from the diaspora. And so now, with the word and belief of Jesus and the resurrection, well, some of these people are now being enfolded into the church. Who's going to take care of them? So then they ordained these 7, what today we call deacons, to take care of these widows that were from the diaspora. And if you look at the names of these deacons, they were also from the diaspora. So they, like Paul, were Jews and Romans, part of that Greco-Roman culture. Now, what happens very early on, the dispute that happens around Stephen, because he's sort of the leading one of these individuals, is between the Greco-Roman Jews who didn't believe in Jesus in Jerusalem and the Greco-Roman Jews who did believe in Jesus in Jerusalem. And so persecution breaks out. And the book of Acts is quite clear that this persecution breaks out, and it's only against the Greco-Roman Jews living in Jerusalem. And so what do? They scatter. And when they go, they sort of follow those of you who kind of grew up in a, let's say for black folks, really. Black folks or Dutch Calvinists always follow these certain lines. If you read Warmth of Other Suns, the migration out of the Jim Crow South happened in similar ways. People follow, oh, my cousin went to Detroit. Oh, my cousin went to LA. I'm going to go to LA by my cousin. That tends to be how people move. And so these Hellenistic Jews leave Jerusalem and they tend to start going to the centers. But part of what happens in the Roman Empire is that there are these major cities where, well, they tend to clump because that's where the economic and cultural opportunity is. So, for example, the Dutch immigration in the United States, you have some of these out-of-the-way places like Ripon, California, or Whitensville, Massachusetts, that you find these little clumps of Christian Reformed churches, but you also find them in northern New Jersey, right outside of New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles. So some of these individuals go to Antioch, and in Antioch, they're talking about Jesus and the resurrection to their Jewish friends, and they start talking to Gentiles. And Gentiles start getting interested, and they start having meetings, and they start sort of doing what synagogues had been doing, reading the Old Testament, applying the Old Testament, applying Jesus' resurrection to the Old Testament, praying, singing, this kind of thing. And this is happening in Antioch among Gentiles. And word comes down to Jerusalem that this is happening. And so they're like, what are we supposed to do with this? And so then Barnabas says, I know just the person who would be perfect. He's completely at home in the Roman world, and he's extremely well educated as a Pharisee. So he could go to Antioch, and so Paul and Barnabas go to Antioch. And that in some ways is the first church, and we know this because in Antioch, for the first time, they're called Christians. So Antioch becomes, and then from Antioch, the group in Antioch then says, we want Paul and Barnabas to travel to more cities and help other groups there. And so that's Paul's missionary journey. We've been covering that in the 11 o'clock service. Okay. The language they're going to use to describe Jesus is they're going to look around and, well, so I was one of the guys from our church in Paterson, New Jersey that I grew up with. It was one of the elders there. You know, in Paterson, again, there was a few kind of like Livingstones here. There's a few old style Dutch CRC folks, and most of the folks in Paterson were black. And so in the church in New Jersey, it was always a mixture of African-American culture and kind of this Dutch Calvinist culture. But one of these guys, he's going to synod and he gets on a plane and he sees all of these other people from all of the other Dutch churches in northern New Jersey going to fly to Grand Rapids. He walks in the plane and he says, I'm Bunau. And of course, that way, yeah, Corinne isn't smiling, but Bunau is this Dutch word that basically means it's hot and humid and muggy. And I don't know any Dutch, but I know Bunau, because it's one of these words that kind of sticks even through the culture. And he said it kind of as an inside joke, because then all of the Dutch CRC people in the airplane coming from the New York area, so most of the people weren't there, they could sort of identify. My point with this is what you do when you're sort of looking to incorporate a new idea, and Jesus' resurrection and who he is in your life as a new idea, is that you sort of take language off the shelf. Because he would say, I'm Bunau, and people would look at him. Bunau isn't a word. Well, it's not an English word. Well, what do you mean? It's another way to say it. It's close. And we don't talk about that here in California much because it's never very humid here. But it's muggy and it's hot and it's warm. The room just feels like it's closing in on you because when it's oppressively hot and humid. It's uncomfortable. But you take language off the shelf and you figure out, how can I communicate all of this history of the Jews and their story, seeing it culminate in Jesus? How can I communicate this to people who don't know the story? You know what you use? Terms that are in the culture. And so what do they use? terms that Roman Caesars had used. And now today, all of this language of the Caesars, it's all gone because the Caesars are gone. We listen to that language and we say, oh, this is Christianese. This is specifically Christian language and talk. And so what happens is they appropriate this language of Jesus is Lord. Well, they used to say Caesar is Lord. Now it's Jesus is Lord. Caesar is Lord, that's forgotten. It's just Jesus is Lord. And so we talked about that in the sermon, and I picked up this book, Roman Imperial Texts. And if you go through this book, it's like, oh, this is a horrible thing because you're ascribing to Caesar all the things that belong to Jesus. Yes, that's right. And what the Christians were doing was ascribing to Jesus all of the things that the people believed belonged to Caesar. And, well, is there the Church of Caesar Augustus here in Sacramento? Not one, but churches all over the place to Jesus. Jesus won. So this new language will be needed that will be faithful to the story of Israel and intelligible to the people of the Roman world. And I walked through some of this, and I'll read some of this. The title, Son of God, was routinely assigned to these Roman emperors. Any resident of the Mediterranean who applied the phrase to someone else was speaking in a politically charged environment, and perhaps would be heard as critiquing the reigning emperor, or at least recognizing that there are other sources of goodness that approached what the emperor could offer. The imperial office was known as a benevolent source of resources for those who could not support themselves and for cities or people who needed financial aid for their region or for an athletic contest. In this section, a variety of text is offered to illuminate the New Testament's Gospels. Even this word gospel was first a Roman political term. These Gospels, according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were written, copied, and canonized by those who regarded Jesus of Nazareth as a divine son who announced the kingdom of God in a way that meant good news for the world. That sounds very Christian to us. That was politically Roman. The Romans had executed this person as a criminal, and yet his followers went on to use the language and imagery that Roman propaganda of the first century typically reserved for the Roman emperor. This section of the source book, this is the book I'm referring to, therefore seeks to help readers consider what the Gospels must have sounded like to those who first heard them. Remember that most early Christians could not read. When they encountered them in the first or second century, we will see in these excerpts that Roman emperors were described as destined to rule, ushering in a golden age, and as benefactors of the whole world. Some of these were deified or proclaimed to be divine when their life on earth ended. All of the emperors in this book mentioned participated in the religion of divine virtues, that is, the worship of certain qualities, such as, now notice the capital letters, peace, victory, concord, hope, faith, as divine entities that could be worshipped. You almost personified these virtues. I'm going to skip down to the other highlighted section. It is obvious that the evangelists and the New Testament authors faced quite a challenge in proclaiming Jesus to be divine and his birth and life as good news in a world where, for the majority of people, the Roman emperor was clearly the Son of God, an ultimate benefactor. A world that, to judge from these sources, was enjoying the golden age brought by Rome's widening rule. Reading the New Testament Gospels alongside the text and images of Imperial Rome might help us hear them in a new way. In other words, Paul has a pretty significant challenge because people can look around and say, well, it's the peace of Rome. Now, peace is a little relative if you look at the details, but it's sort of we might say the tyranny of Rome, that, well, there's not blood in the streets because the Roman Empire is keeping order. One of the things that you notice if you read the Gospels, which are primarily located among the Jews in Galilee and Judea, who really want to get rid of the Roman yoke, the Roman Empire is sort of the enemy, the baddies. When you read the stories from the other places where Paul is roaming, notice how, well, they're sort of the good guys sometimes. Sometimes bad, sometimes good. It's a much different take on the experience of living in the Roman Empire. And so we'll notice that as we continue to go through Paul's work. Now, I want to talk a little bit about psychology and how we imagine things. Because we're going to talk, this is a letter from Paul to the Romans. So when we hear that, what do we think? Who are the Romans? Well, the bad guys, for some, the people in Rome. They're the people in Rome. But when we think about a city, well, when you think about Sacramento, what do you think about? The capital. Okay. Right away, some building, image, thing goes to mind. Okay. When you think about Los Angeles, what do you think about? Freeways, waiting in traffic. Okay, when you think about Washington, D.C., what do you think about? U.S. Capitol, seat of government. Now, all of us know Sacramento is way more than the Capitol. When I think about Sacramento, one of my earliest impressions of Sacramento was driving down I-5 and looking at tomatoes on the side of the highway. That's because I first got here during the tomato harvest season, and I thought it was the strangest thing seeing these trucks going down I-5 that were brimming with tomatoes, and they were falling off the trucks and landing on I-5. When I think about Christmas in Sacramento, I think about fog, because my first Christmas here in 1997 was a very wet year. There was a lot of fog that Christmas. So what we do when we think about something too big for us to really capture mentally is we take these images, and we have these images stand for impressions, experiences, things, ways in which something too big operates in our world. Now, this is a quote from C.S. Lewis's book Miracles, where he talks about this dynamic. Because part of what we wrestle with in the Bible, oh, here comes Imelda. Well, I gotta open the door. Maybe they were done with practice and they wanted to. They're just starting. Rick's like, what kind of quality is this? The guy in the middle of the picture runs off. Well, that's what you get in a Sunday school class. C.S. Lewis is making the point, and actually he's talking about the ascension, that I got into C.S. Lewis's book Miracles because part of the dislocation that happened in the modern era after Galileo and Copernicus is that certain elements of the biblical story don't feel to us like they felt to someone who grows up in a culture that imagines, here's the church at the bottom, and then the moon is up here, and the moon is the beginning of the heavens for a medieval and an ancient person. And do you know what's above the moon? The ether is above the moon. Air is below the moon. And then you have the seven stars. And if you read, for example, in the book of Revelation, the seven stars are held in a hand, Jesus' hand. So you have all of these images that are completely natural to the people of the Bible that to us, we don't understand. And so Lewis is trying to help his readers understand some of what's happening with this. And so he's talking about the ascension. And he says, in order to explain this, I must now touch on a subject which is as important, which has an importance quite apart from our present purpose. The book is about miracles, and of which everyone who wishes to think clearly should make himself master as soon as he possibly can. He talks about Owen Barfield. And then he says this, when I think about London, I see a mental picture of Euston Station. Now, I've never been to London. I had to Google Euston Station. Any guesses what Euston Station is? C.S. Lewis didn't drive. He never learned to drive. It's a train station. Because whenever Lewis would go from Oxford to London, now when I say the word Oxford, what do you think of? A college. He goes from Oxford to London, Euston Station. That in his mind is London. When I said, what do you think of Sacramento? The capital. What do you think of Washington, D.C.? Well, those monumental buildings. What do you think of Los Angeles? Freeways. So he says, whenever I think about London, I think about Euston Station. That's the image that comes up in my mind. But when I think, as I do, that London has several million inhabitants, I do not mean that there are several million images of people contained in my image of Euston Station. Nor do I mean that several million of real people live in the real Euston Station. In other words, he knows London is not Euston Station. When I think of London, any guesses what I think about? Big Ben. Big Ben. I think about Big Ben. It's an iconic image of London. It's what I think about because, and I grew up, you'd see pictures of London and there'd be Big Ben. So he knows full well Euston Station is not London. What he recognizes is that there's an image in his mind that he uses sort of as a shortcut to think about London, just like freeways in Los Angeles, Capitol in Sacramento, monuments in Washington, D.C. In fact, I have the image while I'm thinking about London. What I think about or say is not about that image and would be manifest nonsense if it were. It makes sense because it is not about my own mental pictures, but about the real London outside of my imagination, of which no one can have an adequate mental picture at all. Okay, so we live in Sacramento. Right now, all of our attention and consciousness is focused in this room. In fact, most of this room you're blurring out. Because if I were to ask you without turning around what's behind you in this room, what's behind you in this room? Don't turn around and look. Windows, the wall, bookcases. What's on the bookcases? Books, Bibles. You guys have a pretty good... You're quite familiar with this room. Nobody said those two vacuum cleaners. They've been in this room ever since we started using it after COVID, but you never see them. Now, if I had a cockatoo in a cage in this room and you walked into the room, every one of you would see it because it's different. But if I add a little something or another that your mind expects to see in the room, you won't even see it. That's how our mind works. And so we have to, the world is far too complex. So right now we're in this room and I've got the window open. So I'm watching City Life. You know, they're worried about making sure they get out on time. And so they're moving all of their stuff. And that's what's happening. And every single one of those people in that room is having their own mental experience. They're focused on moving carpets or moving books or taking down the sound system or how did the service go and meeting with people and can we... That's just here. Sam lives next door. What's Sam doing? Well, he's probably awake, maybe making breakfast, maybe watching TV. Maybe he's already at work over at the airport. How about Sam's wife? Well, his kids are kind of grown. Well, how about the people across the street? How about the homeless guy who's right over there? It's not Daniel, it's Mike. How about Billy, who's probably over in the corner feeling pretty wet and cold right now? Sacramento is full of far more than any of us can think or imagine. And so what we do is we condense it down into images. images that somehow the small thing relates to the whole. This is the challenge we're going to have with Rome, because Rome is one of the most famous cities in all of human history. And if I say Rome, people think of maybe a fountain, maybe the Vatican, maybe Roman emperors, maybe the Colosseum, maybe lions eating Christians in the Colosseum, maybe togas, maybe seven hills. There's a world that's connected to Rome. And we have the questions, how do we take a world and sift it down into something small enough for us to manage and think about productively? And this is what Lewis talks about here. It makes sense because it's not my own mental image pictures, but about the real London outside my imagination, of which no one can have an adequate mental picture at all. Or again, when we say that the sun is 90-odd million miles away, we understand perfectly clearly what we mean by this number. We can divide it and multiply it by other numbers. We can work out how long it would take to travel that distance at any given speed. But this clear thinking is accompanied by imagining, which is ludicrously false to what we know the reality might be. Okay, let's imagine we're going to travel to the sun, 93 million miles away. If we could go a million miles an hour, it would take us 93 hours. We can think that way. But we say, okay, I'm going to go to the sun and I'm going to travel a million miles an hour and I'm going to get there. What have I just sort of eliminated from that whole story? Everything else. Let's say I'm talking to some homeless dude and he's telling me how he's an unmedicated schizophrenic and he's telling me how he's going to travel to the sun and he knows it's 93 million miles away and he knows what a million miles an hour means. And so he says, I'm going to travel to the sun at a million miles an hour and it's going to take me 93 hours. And you'd say, well, he did the math right. What's he going to travel in? And do you know how hot the sun is? The sun doesn't have a surface like this planet has a surface. And I mean, just a million details we just sort of blur out. And we do the same thing with every story, with every movie. Every time you watch a movie, it's this story with all of these characters, but I watched Dune last night, but okay, they're traveling through space and you know, it's suspension of disbelief because there's whole worlds of things that you say, none of this makes any sense, but I don't care. I'm going to listen to the story. And the story is real in a certain sense and important in a certain sense and powerful. So this is Rome. What is this? And do you recognize this image? Okay, kind of reminds you of Artemis of Ephesus, which was this statue that was full of breasts. This is a wolf. Any idea who the two little baby boys are under the wolf? Romulus and Remus. Romulus. Romulus. Boy, doesn't that kind of look like Rome? So, Rome. Rome has a story about its beginning. And it's what we call a myth. Now, when I say the word myth, what do you think about? A story that's not based on fact. But we might also say a fiction. What's the difference between a fiction and a myth? Right. So when we think Sacramento is the capital, that's sort of like a myth. Because, well, but in this case, there really is a Capitol building in Sacramento. And laws really do get passed there. But is Sacramento the Capitol building? It's so much more. But we use the image of the Capitol building as a placeholder for far more than we can talk about. The story of Romulus and Remus is one of the long-standing myths of Rome. Now, I want to look at some of it, so that's why I have this piece of paper here today. Now, Cicero, any idea who Cicero was? Does name sound familiar? Name sounds familiar. He was a Roman senator who was one of the top Roman senators who ever lived, and he also wrote a lot. And so we know a lot about Rome from Cicero. Cicero's is not the best known version of the foundation story. This story connected with this picture of the wolf and these two little boys. This is one of Rome's foundation stories. What's the foundation story of the city of Sacramento? Ah, see, right away, Gold Rush. And when you think of Gold Rush, what do you think about? Migration. Do any of you know any gold miners? Well, maybe Roger likes to play around with gold panning. At least he used to for a while. No, because they're all dead. None of us know any 49ers, but we have this picture of, well, the San Francisco 49ers, but they're sort of remembering the 49ers. And then you say Sutter's Fort. Now, it's really interesting. When I asked you about Sacramento, you could have said Sutter's Fort. Because in some ways, Sutter's Fort is more foundational to a city being here than the Capitol, because Sutter's Fort came first. And California becomes part of the United States because of the gold rush and all of these people moving west. Now, we could have also talked about Mormons, because there's that story. And so all around the gold rush, there's all of this mythology. Now, there's truth beneath it, but there's all this mythology. Well, today there's a big debate about, was Romulus ever a real person? And we asked that question. We want to know if there was a physical baby called Romulus that actually survived in the wild because a she-wolf suckled him and his twin brother. One of the most one of this underlies the most modern accounts that goes back, especially essentials to Livy. Now, Livy is another ancient Roman historian. For the writer whose work is so important to our understanding of early Rome, surprisingly little is known of Livy the man. And then she talks about him a little bit more. He began writing his compendium of Roman history around the 20s BCE, that's 20 BC, and was on close enough terms with the Roman imperial family to have encouraged the future emperor Claudius to take up history writing. Inevitably, the story of Romulus and Remus features prominently in his first book, and rather less geography and rather more colorful narratives than Cicero gives it. Livy starts with the twins, then briskly follows through the tale that later achievements of Romulus alone as Rome's founder and first king. Okay, why on earth are we talking about Romulus and Remus when we're talking about the Apostle Paul? Because just in the same way that Sutter's Fort and the Capitol are part of the story of Sacramento and part of the story of, let's say, Sacramento Christian Reformed Church and now Living Stones Christian Reformed Church, well, actually, the Capitol and Sutter's Fort have everything to do with this church. How did Maury get here? He came here to work. He came here to work with water. Well, what does water have to do with a gold rush? All of that water was slowly bringing gold out of the mountains and depositing it in those riverbeds. And the people here before the Europeans, they didn't care about gold. They left it here. The Europeans got here and discovered these rivers are full of gold. Well, Sacramento is at the convergence of the American River and the Sacramento River. And, well, San Francisco is just at the other end of the Delta. I mean, this stuff all holds together. And why the capital is here, I was just talking to Rick about this and said, well, for a while they thought about Auburn because why? Why would they think about Auburn for the capital of California? What does Auburn not do that currently we're having a little bit of a reminder about what can happen in Sacramento? Flooding. So, yeah, Sacramento Valley would always flood. So, when we talk about the Romans, we have to talk about something that is essential to the story of Rome. Now, when we looked at it from the Gospels, why were the Roman centurions the bad guys in the Gospels? Who was Rome and what did they do? They took over Israel. What does that have to do with this picture of a wolf? What is essential to Rome? Power. Rome. Romans are wolves. What do wolves do? They devour. Book of Daniel. These monsters come out of the sea. What do those monsters have all these animal qualities to them? And what do they do? They devour. Now, Romans aren't literally wolves. They're men. But they act like wolves. Why? Why do the Romans act like wolves? Well, who is their founder? Who is their leader? Who is their king? Romulus is their king. Why is Romulus so much like a wolf? He was raised by a wolf. Now wait till you see some of the other elements of this story. The little boys, Livy explains, were born to a virgin priestess. Hey, wait a minute. Romulus was born to a virgin by the name of Rhea, Silvia, in the Italian town of Alba Longa, in the Alban Hills, just south of the latter site of Rome. She had not taken this virginal office of her own free will, but had been forced into it after an internecine struggle for power that saw her uncle, Amulius, take over as king of Alba Longa after ousting his brother, Numitor, her father. Okay. So, Romulus and Remus's mother is a virgin priestess. Now, let's think about the Gospel of Luke. Who do we meet in the Gospel of Luke very clearly? Another virgin, Mary. And the angel comes to Mary and says, favored of God, God is going to do a great thing through you. You're going to conceive not of a man, and you're going to bear a son, and he's going to be king of the world. Now, who does Luke write his gospel to? Romans. Why is Luke telling a story like that to Romans? Wait a minute. Romulus. Romulus is born of a virgin priestess. He's the king of Rome. But notice, Mary says what to the angel? Let it be so. Is this virgin going to conceive? Well, let's find out how she conceives. First of all, there's this whole power struggle around her, and her father has been ousted of his kingdom. Amulius then had used the cover of the priesthood, an ostensible honor, to prevent the awkward appearance of any heirs and rivals from his brother's line. As it turns out, this precaution failed. For Rhea Silvia was soon pregnant. She's pregnant. Who's she pregnant by? According to Livy, she claimed that she had been raped by the god Mars. One of the things that you're going to find throughout Roman mythology are the constant presence of rape. Now, if you're asking a question, what is Rome? Well, what is Rome? Rome's first king, after whom Rome is named of, is the son of rape, suckled by wolves. This is Rome. Oh. Now, she's raped by the god Mars. Any idea who the god Mars is? Okay. We have something else in our world that's Mars. What is that? A planet. Now, remember, the moon is up here, and above the moon is ether, and there are seven stars. And those stars, thinking astrologically, like most people of the world, what do those stars do? They control things in the world, right? Now, again, at the beginning of the book of Revelation, Jesus is holding the seven stars in his hand. What is the book of Revelation saying about Jesus? He's sovereign. Now, Mars, among the planets that we know of, is a little unique. Why? Has to do with color. It's a little reddish. What else is red? Blood. Mars is the god of war. So, what is Rome? Rome is the product of Romulus, who is suckled by wolves, born of a virgin who is raped by the god of war. You would think this would have been made up by enemies of Rome. We hear that today because all of those things are negative characteristics. Those are only negative characteristics because we are so deeply Christian, we don't even recognize it anymore. This is power. This is the power to take over and devour and own the world. This is Rome. Livy appears to have to be as doubtful about this as Cicero. Rome, he suggests, might have been a convenient pretext to cover an entirely human affair. So Cicero and Livy are kind of like, well, that's the story, but, you know, she's supposed to be a virgin priestess. Yeah, probably didn't happen. One of the early claims, as the Christian story becomes more and more well known, is what do they say about Mary? Mary had an affair with a Roman soldier, and they even come up with a name. Why are they saying that? Because Rome and Jesus are about to be competitors. As soon as she gave birth to twins, Amulius ordered his servants to throw the babies into the nearby river Tiber to drown. Hey, wait a minute. That sounds like a story I know. What story does that sound like? Moses. But they survived. Oh, I wonder how they survived. For as often happens in stories like these in many cultures, the men who had been given this unpleasant task did not or could not bring themselves to follow the instructions to the letter. Instead, they left the babies in a basket, not directly in the river, but as it was in flood next to the river that burst its banks. Before the babies were washed away to their death, the famous nurturing wolf came to their rescue. Livy was one of those Roman skeptics who tried to rationalize this particularly implausible aspect of the tale. The Latin word wolf, or lupa, was also used as a colloquial term for prostitute. Could it have been that a local prostitute rather than a local wild beast had found and tended the youths? But again, the point here is not so much we try to think, well, what happened? Well, there's huge skepticism as to whether or not Romulus was a physical person the way we are. But it's in many ways beside the point when it comes to what is Rome. Well, this is Rome's story. Whatever the identity of the Lupa, a kindly herdsman or shepherd found the boys and took them in. Was his wife the prostitute? Livy wondered. Romulus and Remus lived as part of his country family, recognizing until years later when they accidentally reunited with their grandfather, the deposed King Numitor. Once they had reinstated him as king of Alba Longa, they set out to establish their own city. But they soon quarreled with disastrous results. Livy suggests that the same rivalry and ambition that had marred the relationship between Numitor and Amulius trickled down to the generations to Romulus and Remus. The twins disagreed about where exactly to site their new foundation, in particular, which one of the seven hills that made up the city, there in fact more than the famous seven, should form the center of the first settlement. Romulus chose the hill known as the Palatine, where the emperor's grand residence later stood, and which was given us the name Pallas. That's where the word comes from. There are various versions of what happened next, but the commonest, according to Livy, was that Romulus responded by killing his brother. So because the sole ruler of the place that took his name and became the sole ruler of the place that took his name, as he struck the terrible fratricidal blow, he shouted in Livy's words, "So perish anyone who shall leap over my walls." It was appropriate slogan for a city which went on to portray itself as a belligerent state, but one whose wars were always in response to aggression of the other and always just. Yeah. So one brother kills the other brother. Wait a minute. I remember a story like that. Cain and Abel. And then Cain actually has a descendant who brags about, well, Cain is avenged seven times. I'm avenged 77 times. This is Romulus. Now, what is therefore the mystique around Romulus? Sacramento is known by its capital, maybe Sutter Fort. The American Capitol is known by the White House, the Capitol building, the monument buildings. This is Rome, suckled by wolves. A brother even willing to kill his own brother if need be. He's the son of the god of war. Now, if you keep following Roman history, you will find all of these stories continue to go down through history. And the point to all of their enemies and adversaries is, don't mess with us. We are bigger. We are badder. We will destroy you. We will own you. We will conquer you. If you comply with us, we can be merciful. But if you cross us, we will destroy you. When it comes to the world of the first century that we are talking about, this is Rome. And Rome has demonstrated this around the world again and again and again and again. And so when we read in the Gospels who Rome is, that's what the Gospels are saying. But now, these are Jews. What would Jews say about Rome? And the Jews' legacy and promise. What do the Jews believe about themselves? They're the chosen people. And read those Old Testament prophets about the restoration of Israel and them being on the highest mountain and them ruling the world. Well, the second half of these visions in the book of Daniel practically write themselves. What is God going to do to Rome? Well, read the book of Revelation. Now, the book of Revelation doesn't really talk about Rome. Who does the book of Revelation talk about?
Babylon.
Now, one of the points I make with a lot of these books is, so in the timeline of Israel, let's say you have David at about 1,000, 586 BC, Babylon comes in and destroys the temple. Persia comes back, rebuilds the temple, and that's the second temple, and that goes all the way to, say, Jesus is about 4 BC. And then another important date is 70 BC. What happens in 70 BC?
Rome destroys the temple.
The book of Revelation, towards the end of the first century. I think almost all of the books of the New Testament are before this date. And I think part of the reason the book of Revelation is the shape that it is because the book of Revelation keeps talking about Babylon. And all of these things about Babylon the Great. Babylon the Great is a whore astride a beast. This is Rome. Now, the author of the book of Revelation isn't going to say Rome. Why? But we can talk about Babylon because Babylon and Rome are kind of the same thing in picture thinking, in mythology. They function the same way. Now, a new leader is born of a virgin. And he's going to be very different from this picture. He isn't suckled by wolves. He isn't the product of rape. And, when we read the Gospels, everyone wants this Jesus to act like Babylon and Rome. That's what he keeps being spurned on to do. You've gathered a crowd, arm them, take out the fortress that's sitting right next to our temple. Do the work to put God's people at the top. Well, what is the work that he's going to do to put God's people at the top? It's the most insane story you've ever heard. Because Rome makes its living by killing. I'm going to defeat Rome by being killed by it. It's like, excuse me? Can defeat Rome by being killed by it? Yeah. And then I'm going to kill the chief instrument of Rome. How did Romulus achieve supremacy over his brother? He killed him. What is Rome? Rome achieves supremacy over the world by killing its adversaries. Jesus receives supremacy over the world by being killed, rising again. And now we have Paul writing to Rome. The whole story is going to become undone. Now, we're used to it because we're 2,000 years later. But I want us to see and understand this story, because this story is behind everything we read in the New Testament, including the book of Rome, the book to the Romans. Now, next week, I'm going to take this a little further because, Paul is the product of Jerusalem and Rome. We've seen a whole bunch of negative things about Rome this week. Next week, we're going to look at some aspects of Rome that I would say by common grace get pulled into this story to actually help address some of negative things that had come into this culture. Because what's interesting is that there were these synagogues all over the ancient world before Rome conquered it. Why didn't those synagogues conquer Rome the way the churches did? We're going to have to figure that out next week. And it has everything to do, again, with this question of Rome. Because, again, Paul is not just a Jew. He's Roman. And so he's going to bring this together. So any questions? Was this helpful?
Fascinating.
Because, I mean, this mythology, everybody knew this mythology for years and years and years. If you had a classical education, this is what you learned. And then when you learn it as a Christian, you begin to see it. It's like, oh, this stuff all fits together. How could the gospel become intelligible to these people where they started to become Christians? Let's pray. Lord, the world is too big for us to capture in our minds. Sacramento might be the Capitol building. It might be Sutter's Fort. It might be tomatoes on the side of the highway. Los Angeles might be a great big freeway. Washington, D.C. might be those monument buildings. Rome might be a fountain or Caesar's or... And in the time that Paul writes this book to the Romans, a wolf, the product of a rape of a god of war, suckled by a wolf who kills his own brother and goes to be predator and master of the world by violence and bloodshed. And now 2,000 years later, we're going to read the book of Romans, understanding that the King of Kings and the Prince of Peace, and someone for whom Roman titles were much more aptly true, conquered the wolf and the child of the wolf and the child of the rape of a god. Help us, Lord, to understand how Christ continues to reign and how Christ continues to rule. And we ask, Lord, that you'd give us your Spirit, that your Spirit may rule through us as well. So hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen. All right, Rick.